Welcome to Holden Village. Today is Tuesday, August the 22nd, 1995. In the Creekside Room this evening, our speaker is Dion Stuthman, and he is speaking on Let's Emphasize Why Not How When We Think About Creation. Let's listen in on Dion Stuthman.
I was a sort of a late addition to the teaching staff. I didn't get all of my homework done, and one of the things is that I didn't get a list of books to be ordered by the bookstore, but I'll sort of weave that into to this discussion, and you'll get some notion. I think what I'm going to do is to leave an order with the bookstore that they would acquire copies of this book, The Active Life, by Parker Palmer. I know that some people are familiar with this book. I was involved in a book study led by the campus pastor at the University of Minnesota. And there's two sentences in here that sort of really, and then some discussions with him that created this title tonight. Too many of us consent or are forced to spend time doing things for which we have no heartfelt reason. If we were asked, why are you doing this? We would not know how to answer. Thus the emphasis on the why as far as creation is concerned. I did go, spent a little bit of time in the library here, and I'll put these back as soon as we're done tonight so that you could have a chance to, this you'll find in the reference part of the library closest to us now. There's sort of an adjunct or an annex to the library. It's called Care of the Earth, put out by the Lutheran School of Theology in Chicago. One of the articles in here is Thinking Like a Mountain. A survey of environmental ethics written by Martha Ellen Storz, who's a professor of historical theology, I think it is, at Pacific Lutheran Seminary in California. The title, Thinking Like a Mountain, comes from the challenge by Aldo Leopold with regard to how we might think about the environment and caring for it, and there's a little suggestion about that he made that I'll refer to later as well. As I just went sort of quickly through the library, this one is The Agony of Affluence by William Wells. I don't really know this author, but it has a sort of an intriguing title. And looking at it, basically his purpose in writing the book is to provide some contextual interpretations, understandings of economic advice, statements, recommendations, and so forth that were that have been given in the Bible, and with his argument that the literal translation of some of those statements and so forth needs an updating with regard to context, like a lot of other things. Befriending the Earth, Thomas Berry, and written with Thomas Clark. I want to read very quickly because this also describes basically the point I'm trying to make. Before going into the Christian story, the Christ story, the religious story, we need to go back into the human story. We are beginning to revise our sense of the human venture. The human, once considered the glory of creation, is now viewed as the destructive force in creation. The human has become the disaster of the earth. There is even question now of the viability of the human species. The issue is not whether or not Christianity is viable or whether any other tradition is viable. The question is the viability of the human, or more pointedly, the viability of the planet Earth in its basic life systems as long as humans are around. And just to give you a little. Also, in the tape library, there's this blue or green covered little handout booklet that has a list of tapes that are specifically on environmental issues, and although I didn't have time to look at all of those, you can, if you get into the tape library, there's a file about that thick, E, and I think all but one of them are on the environment for E, so. One other, Caring for Creation by Ann Rawthorn. Something that I found in here that I think is particularly in her introduction, talking about the astronauts, seeing this has changed a man, has to make a man appreciate the creation of God and the love of God. And from the same perspective, Yuri, I can't pronounce that Russian name, a Soviet cosmonaut said, "It isn't important in which sea or lake you observe a slick of pollution, or in the forest of which country a fire breaks out, or on which continent a hurricane arises. You are standing guard over the whole of our Earth. As with the astronauts and cosmonauts, so with us. We too stand as guards over the whole of our Earth. And the critical question for us is, what kind of guards will we be? Will we care for creation with responsibility and with love?" And then finally, "Today I set before you life and death, blessing and curse. Therefore choose life, that you and your descendants may live." And in one sense, for me, that's what sustainability is all about, so that our descendants can live. Finally, this is a book, called "How Much Land Can 10 Billion People Spare for Nature?" It's written by an agricultural colleague of mine. I worked very hard in the editing process to try to change the tone of some of this, but so it goes. This is a book, and this will actually also relate and tie into the next session, a book that really stresses the notion of proper application of technology will increase the supply of food, and that's how we will handle the mandate to feed 10 billion people. Obviously, as I've suggested, I have a different point of view.
Would you mind passing that one around?
Sure. It's written by a member of the National Academy of Science. I don't even aspire to becoming a member of the National Academy of Science, so I guess it's not my place to necessarily challenge. However, I still think that my point of view has some validity. Okay. "In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth." And so the story of Genesis begins. The concentration in the first part is on who and on what, as the following chapters give some additional details. However, there's not much in the way of insight relative to how. And it perhaps may be that void is one of the reasons why we have such long-standing, intense, emotional debates about whether it's creation, evolution, or whatever. My point simply is that how has already been decided, taken place, and to continue to argue and debate about how seems to me not to be very interesting, for one, and neither is it particularly useful. Because I think that the bigger question, more important question, is what is why, and the, another way to state that is, what is the human purpose in the context of creation and its continuation? Let me just start trying to engage you in some dialogue by asking you, who or what is the most important part of creation? Anybody?
God.
Let's leave the creator out and just talk about the creation.
The wholeness of it.
Okay, that's
the system.
That's a particular viewpoint, but the one that I think is maybe more prevalent would be us, people.
Yeah.
Well, I'm just, I'm not agreeing with that.
I don't agree with that.
I'm not agreeing with it either, but I think if you ask people in a general sort of way, what's the most important part of the creation, they're going to say people. And in fact, there's a...
that's the politically correct thing to say.
I don't think
that
is.
Well,
maybe not up
depends.
Here.
But there is another place in the scripture, and if I knew this better by heart, I could find it quicker. Anyway, the reason it would be given, let me just put this one, I'll paraphrase it. The reason it would be given is because people, humans, are created in the image of God, and that is not ascribed to any of the other parts of the creation, and therefore, at least for some people, that would be justification for some level of superiority.
That wasn't what I was really meaning. I was really meaning as the ongoing care of creation.
Okay.
If you're going to exclude God, you don't want that as an answer, then certainly we are the ones who have to
but again,
be part of the
reason that we sort of have that assignment, I think, is because in one way, it's because we are created in the image of God, and in one sense might be viewed as representatives thereof.
If you read Genesis, I mean, it says that we're the stewards of the earth, and supposed to take care of it.
Yeah, the point about the asking you about the most important part of creation, though, really has ultimately to do with the notion that there's a hierarchical order as far as creation is concerned, and people are at the top, and then most people would put animals, and then people would put plants, and keep going to more and more simpler forms of life. And to the extent that, I mean, that makes some sense, it also, though, however, gives us some special role and responsibility, as you were mentioning about caring, and it also, I think, as you translate down the line, it also gives the church a role, or at least an opportunity to play a role with regard to how people might discharge those responsibilities. And the other point I guess I'd make is the following. There's also instruction here in Genesis, to be specific. And God blessed them, and God said to them, be fruitful and multiply, and fill the earth and subdue it, and have dominion over the fish of the sea and over the birds of the air and over every living thing that moves upon the earth. Now, that particular passage and a couple of those words in there, particularly subdue and dominion, subdue is kind of hard to almost modify the meaning of. There are people now working hard, scholars, on trying to put together a somewhat different interpretation of the word dominion to get away from the notion of domination and to at least include the concept of stewardship, that is taking, not only tilling the land, but also taking care of it.
I think different translations do use more like stewardship words, don't they?
Well, it depends. In fact, you know, there's enough translations floating around here. If you're not careful, you grab the wrong one, and you don't look at it ahead of time when you start reading it. It won't. The words won't make the point that you want to make. So. But this particular one does talk about that. I guess the point I would make, though, is that a couple of verses later it says, "And God said everything He had made, and God saw everything that He had made, and behold, it was very good. And there was evening, and there was morning, a sixth day." It just seems to me it doesn't make much sense. Once the creation is completed, God looks at it and decides that it's very good, that God would have given instructions to, in effect, that would in effect cause a deterioration of that good piece of work that God had done. And so I think we need to be very careful about the whole context of be fruitful and multiply. Well, even that, you're talking about being fruitful and multiplying, and if you go beyond that to a strategy that diminishes the resources that are available on the planet, so that when more and more people arrive, they have less and less to live with. As a minimum, it seems to me that's sort of like a cruel hoax. And so I think, again, it would one needs to be careful how the interpretation of dominion, and particularly dominion, subdue is a little bit more of a difficult word to deal with. I've listened to a couple of tapes today, some by Professor Rose Stoltz, and she sort of bypassed that word and then spent most of the time on dominion, and that's what I'm going to do as well.
So you're in good company.
Yeah, right. Well, at least for the moment, anyway. Looks like reasonably friendly company, too. In Genesis 2, 15, there are some additional, if you will, instructions about what the human purpose is. Lord God took the man and put him in the Garden of Eden to till it and to keep it. And I think that also, the and keep it part, I think, goes at least to talking about stewardship relative to dominion, and perhaps even beyond that. So, people are, I think, now thinking in many ways about being with nature as they would try to keep it and not be against nature. Professor Stoltz also makes the point that perhaps currently many theologians are sort of in conflict with many ecologists. Even if, as we're talking about in updating or putting a new interpretation on the word dominion, which includes stewardship, that still sort of talks about or suggests the whole notion of management. Just another little sort of aside, we talk about raw materials, for example, as part of the creation. And that sort of leaves the impression that humans will come along and finish the job, so to speak. Ecologists, and now I'm separating ecologists from environmentalists, okay? Some of them may be one and the same, but ecologists, and going back to Leopold again, what we're really talking about, what he's really suggesting, is that we enhance the integrity, the stability, and the beauty of the entire biosphere. And that's quite a bit different than just necessarily managing the resources that might be present in that biosphere. What it really implies is that one needs to know that entire biosphere and the component parts and how they work together very well to be able to enhance the integrity, the stability, and the biosphere.
Yeah. Would you just differentiate a little more between environmentalist and ecologist?
Well, I think to a certain extent, even in environmentalists, in many cases, are still, it's sort of a, in many ways, their points are sort of a different version, or they would just like a particular kind of stewardship. But it's still pretty much more of a managing of the resources, as opposed to ecologists, in which they're actually trying, learning how the pieces fit together first. That might help you and give you some guidance in terms of, at that point, if you were to think about managing, if you want to. But the first thing is that you learn how all the pieces fit together, what the grand scheme of things is. And I'm going to come to the next point about the fact that, again, Professor Stoltz suggests there's a reason why we're not at that point. And basically, as other people have suggested also, that the root of the problem with regard to our not being able to fully understand and comprehend the best caring for creation lies in the wrong interpretation of the concept of dominion and the subduing part. And that's basically has religious roots. And so she suggests if the problem has religious roots, then perhaps the solution to the problem also needs to be in roots from religion. So she argues, and for the moment, I'm willing to at least repeat the argument, and perhaps even feel more strongly than that about it, that we should be spending more time, as far as Genesis is concerned, on the third chapter, talking about the fall and the curses, or the aftermath, as I written up there, resulting from the fall. Now, I think probably all of you know who the three sort of key players were in the fall. One of them is the serpent, one of them is Eve, and one of them is Adam. Each played a role, and each, with curses, suffered the consequences. Professor Stoltz suggests that the result of the fall, in terms of creation, there are now six broken relationships. And I'm just wondering if that has any meaning for you, and if you could identify particular relationships as far as creation is concerned that were broken as far as the fall and the curses that followed there. The relationship of humans and God was changed, that's right.
You can say Hardy Sligerman, Bethel Bible Series, has the four dimensions, the broken relationship between man and God, between humans, the man and the woman, between the man and the earth, and between man and himself.
She lists them in they're a little bit different. She starts at the top with the serpent. There's a broken relationship between animals and the earth, and that the serpent was given curses such that that's the case. Also because the serpent was put down below other animals as part of the curse as well, that there's a broken relationship among animals. And then between animals and humans, because the serpent was a marked species from then on. In fact, you know, at least I was told once, and I think this makes some sense, most people, when they see a snake, what's the first thing they're going to do? Assume that they have a chance to do it. Yeah, exactly. And that's presumably part of that manifestation. In a more general sort of way, also among humans, then a broken relationship between humans and the earth. Part of the curse was that from then on, thorns and thistles, as well as other things, would be growing, and it would take sweat on the brow to produce the food and other things. And then, as you all first mentioned, the notion of humans and God. Now, our point is this, that current and traditional Christology is one-dimensional relative to those six broken relationships. It only deals with the human and God and excludes basically the other five relationships. And at least some of those relationships obviously have to do with our coming to an understanding of how we might best care for creation. Either the relationship among humans, between humans and animals, also the relationship between humans and earth. And
right, you said traditionally?
Traditional and even current Christology primarily emphasizes the...
Because there is this thing in Paul about the whole creation groans.
That's, she did also cite that as further evidence to, for her point of view, that with the primary emphasis on personal salvation and the relationship to people and God, that that leads to a human-centered universe. And she's then arguing that if we broaden Christology to deal with all six of those broken relationships, we would produce a Christ-centered universe and creation. And then we, that would almost certainly lead to a better understanding of people and how they might care for the creation. And as I say, at the moment, it makes some sense to me. I know that there's, well, the whole notion of what created this whole idea for me in the first place, people spending hours and hours and pounds, not just ounces of emotion, arguing about creation versus evolution, instead of more useful things about what they might do with the creation, or the evolution for that matter. So that's one thing. I also would like to bring in the idea of the flood and then ask the question whether or not you think there might be some important lessons as a result of the flood and what happened during that event. And I'm thinking specifically with regard to the ultimately the instructions that were given to Noah with regard to two of every kind except for the clean animals, where they took, where it was to take seven of every kind. Does that for you have any, speak to anything about, for example, endangered species?
Yes.
Okay. I'm going to get rid of some of these.
Were the seven animals like that for sacrifices, though?
Buzz might be able to help us.
Well, I can help, but I'm a little confused because everything that I've read is convoluted. You uh-huh. can't get a straight answer. It's the same problem with the words dominion and subdue. The Hebrew vocabulary of the Bible is so limited. Words have so many meanings. But to try to straighten it out, you just get into all kinds of problems. And that's true with the flood story, it seems. Right. So many conclusions.
Well, in fact, the more I got to thinking about this, I learned this story way back when, and there's a couple of things about this story that I think that we ought to think about. One of them is there, if you just sort of take it for as it's presented, you might assume that the flood included the entire planet. but it might have also been less than the entire planet. That's not, at least as far as I can tell, that's not necessarily clear. Again, another thing is, I'm just going to read you part of the instructions to Noah. So make yourself an ark of cypress wood. Make rooms in it and coat it with pitch inside and out. And that's good advice. It'll make it waterproof. This is how you are to build it. The ark is to be 450 feet long, 75 feet wide, and 45 feet high. Now that's a major sort of structure. On the other hand, if you think about an ark that's that size, and think about all the species and all the animals that we have, it's going to be a tough time getting them all fit in there, I think. Another little thing that I wanted to just share with you, because I suggest there's a number of ways that one could take all the species of things in the world. If I recall correctly, there's something like 300,000 of them. It might even be more than that, but there's a big number anyway. So here's a possible temptation that Noah might have had, given that perhaps there wasn't enough room for everything. This is by Helen Castle, and I don't know if any of you know her or not, but anyway. If Noah had been truly wise, he would have swatted those two flies. Now, I've heard lots of reference to that the last 2 days. I think if the story of the flood and the ark and the instructions has any meaning to you, then it also should have some insight in terms of even flies have some place. I guess I'm thinking that basically one could divide the species into three categories, and there's all kinds of categories that you could use, but this is at least one kind. Useful and competitive. And of course, all of us would put humans into that category, given the other two that I have. Nearly extinct, endangered, and therefore obviously not very competitive, otherwise they wouldn't be nearly extinct and or endangered. And for those of you who live out in this part of the country, I'm sure that you have heard about the spotted owl, and even more recently the efforts with regard to one of the salmon that some people would like to put on the endangered list, I think it is. Then the third category, and this is the one that's really tough. I've chosen to label it as obnoxious, and usually very competitive. That's one of the reasons why it's usually obnoxious, is that there's many more than what we think we need or would like to have around.
Are you speaking on these from the human
viewpoint? Because
animals or plants now?
Both. I was initially planning that we were going to have that room instead of this room, but we struck a deal because they wanted to show an 18-minute tape. I have only a 4-minute tape. And the 18-minute tape for their presentation is sort of the core of the presentation. I can tell you about the 4-minute tape in a way, although it would have been nice to have seen it. The reason I'm putting these into these three categories is because in just a little bit, I'm going to sort of ask you to split into about three groups. And then I'm going to ask you to come up with a strategy that you would have used if you were Noah and got the assignment to do the two of every kind and so forth, and all the other things that you'd have to do to manage that operation for how many ever days it was that all of these organisms were in this ark. The collection of the two animals is just part of the operation relative to keeping that going. In fact, John Schramm the other day talked about somebody who said something about, I can't remember what it was, but anyway, ultimately he's talking about the stink in the inside of the ark. And that'll give you a little clue about what I'm thinking about in addition to just figuring out which ones they are. The videotape is a case study that actually I was involved in sort of on the receiving end. As I told you, I'm a oat researcher, and I have a number of plots for evaluating the various kinds of genotypes and so forth right on the campus, St. Paul campus, University of Minnesota, which is right in the middle of a relatively large metropolitan area, and lots of sparrows. Probably as many sparrows as some places have flies. Here, maybe. And those sparrows can, when they form flocks of 400, 500, 600, can swoop in, so to speak, and within a half an hour can ruin some graduate student's thesis project for at least a year and perhaps longer than that. And so we had a sort of a traditional kind of approach to this in which we had various kinds of traps. These are one-way traps. The birds could get in, but they never could figure out how to get out. And so we were able to, over the years, capture something like 7,000 or 8,000 birds. And then we either killed them and or fed them to falcons of one kind or another. And one of the rationalizations for continuing to do that was that we really weren't having any impact as far as as creation was concerned, because the next year there were just as many sparrows as there was the last year before we trapped them and got rid of some. However, that didn't necessarily satisfy everybody, and one night we made the 6 o'clock TV news when somebody had videotaped the person who was in charge of the traps and the other things, and didn't take long, and the whole political correctness, in one sense, at least for a couple of groups, descended on us, and then we were no longer trapping birds. But we still had the concern, because the birds were still going to come in from time to time and sort of wipe out our plots. In the process, though, that's one of the reasons why I became more sensitive. It occurred to me that obnoxious species also have a part in creation, and that, in fact, my point is be that we need to come to terms with all three kinds of species. The useful, competitive ones, like we think we are, and others like us. The endangered ones, or the nearly extinct ones. And then also the obnoxious ones, the flies, the sparrows. I could also tell you stories about the Canadian geese. We have something like between 10 and 20,000 Canadian geese within the confines of the metropolitan area. And I can tell you also, in the last 2 weeks, at least 2,000 of them were on the St. Paul campus and in my plots. And they sort of go in there like cows, and they flop down, and things spread around and whatever. They also leave other kinds of messes, and it's very difficult to get crews to go in there and harvest after the geese have been in there, that sort of thing. So, again, now, this sort of gives you an idea that sometimes these categories, that people might even accept the category, but they might move species around. See, I might put geese into an obnoxious category, at least for a month or so of the year. But a lot of other people, I know some people who think geese are, fantastic. And so we don't even always agree on if we were to accept those three categories. But regardless, no, let's just go ahead. We're okay.
Never mind. He's not going to do it.
That's okay. Yeah.
Come on back here.
So what I'm really suggesting in terms of that is that we do need to come to terms with all of these species, whether, and let me just now just say, for instance, you all know what a weed is?
Yes.
Huh?
A plant in the wrong place.
A plant that a human being doesn't want.
That's right. That's the point. A plant in the wrong place, the wrong time. By whose definition? Okay, by ours. Now, again, that goes back to the whole hierarchical notion and the fact that we're superior to most every other form of life. And I would again argue that whereas that might be appropriate, it certainly puts a particular obligation and responsibility on us, if we're going to make those kinds of definitions and enforce them, that we do as much as we can to understand, and from an ecological point of view, how all of the pieces, all of the components of creation are intended to fit together. Because until we understand as best we can those kinds of interworking relationships, it seems to me there's a good chance that some of the rules that we might come up with to serve our own sort of short-term, right now kind of needs, if you will, might be in conflict with the sort of grand scheme of things as far as the total creation is concerned. So, I want to, I do want to just ask you, let's see, one, two, three. Why don't you join those three? And if five of you can go, and then if you'll join the four here, what I'd like you to do for the next about 6 or 7 minutes is you have now been, first of all, you've been given the story that very soon the earth, there's going to be a big flood, which is basically going to destroy the earth. That's what the flood story is. And the second thing is that you have a, once you join that group now, you have a responsibility, you have an opportunity by following these instructions to build this ark to, one, save yourself, and two, to save the elements of creation. Now again, recognize that ark, in one sense, is not going to be necessarily big enough to... and one other point. It talks about the animals, and that's the thing that people all think about, carrying or getting those two animals, two of every kind of animal, into the ark. It also says, and this is something that's particularly important to me as a plant geneticist, that they're supposed to take the food on board for all of those animals. And earlier in Genesis, it also describes then that all the plants, the green plants and so forth, are in fact the food for both humans and for the animals. So there's also going to be two of every kind of plant go onto that ark, not just the animals. And I think sometimes that gets left off. Might also be the reason why some people, for example, have a feeling that animals are much superior to plants. And as you can probably tell, I take a little exception to that, since we ought to, as a minimum, all remember that both are living.
Oh, Lord.
And the waters prevailed upon the earth 150 days, that's 5 months. But God remembered Noah and all the beasts. Let's see, once.
Finally.
And the waters receded from the earth. At the end of 150 days, the waters had abated. And in the seventh month, wait a minute. Well, I think this is it. And in the seventh month, 17th day of the month, the ark came to rest upon the mountains of Ararat.
Ararat. 7 months?
And wait a minute. And the waters continued to abate until the 10th month. In the 10th month, on the first day of the month, the tops of the mountains were seen. At the end of 40 days, which would be the 11th month plus 10 days, opened the window of the ark, which he had made, sent forth a raven, and it went to and fro. Then he sent forth a dove to see if the waters had subsided. But the dove found no place to set her foot, and she returned to the ark. Now, he waited another 7 days. Now we're up to 11 months and 17 days. Sent another dove out. The dove came back and had a freshly plucked olive leaf. So Noah knew the waters had subsided from the earth. Then he waited another 7 days. Now up to... So basically, it's at least 12 months that we're a year that we're in this ark.
And we're assuming that it started at the beginning of the book.
Pardon?
I mean,
says the
40
day
line. But anyway, who cares?
Yeah, well, it's a relatively a long time. So first of all, we need what are the general kind of strategies? And by the way, I just would remind you the 450 feet. You know, it was about a football and a half field for those of you who are sports people. But even so, some of the it's a big sized boat. On the other hand, some of the animals that were probably going to go into that boat were pretty good size too. You've heard the story about where is the elephant going to sleep? Anywhere he wants to. Okay. So how do we come about in terms of acquiring the two animals of every case and seven of a few? Anybody have any trouble with that?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Well, feed you decided.
Awful lot of feed. Yeah, right? Okay. And it's going to have to all be probably stored grain, because in the ark, you aren't going to have enough light to grow any plants. So they're going to have to have been seed. And you'd want to have enough so that you could have seed left over when you got out of the ark. You wouldn't want to eat it all. You don't want to eat your seed corn, so to speak.
About 20 years ago, I think it is, John Huston, the producer and director, did a movie called In the Beginning. It was the first of a series that he was going to do and never completed the rest of the Bible. But he did much of the book of Genesis, included in which was the flood story. And he played the role of Noah himself.
Uh-huh.
And the structure that he built in which this was filmed was according to the smaller of the two cubit figures. And get a hold of the movie. I'm sure the library has it. Maybe the video store does. But it's worth seeing, especially the scene when his wife goes to feed the hippo.
Mm-hmm.
But it is amazing when you see this structure that they designed for the movie based on the biblical dimensions.
Mm-hmm.
And I mentioned that before that I remember reading the equivalent of 400 railroad cattle cars is the capacity of that vessel. So if you want to take the story literally, I think the size is there.
Well, perhaps it is. I mean, on the other hand, the dinosaurs that my grandson is enamored with. Okay?
Sorry about that.
They take up a lot of room, too.
They were extinct before,
yeah. We were
going to
take
them,
but we knew they'd be extinct.
Okay.
So they're on here for a whole year.
So they're on here for a whole year. That's one thing. Can you just take them all out and let them all just sort of whatever? Do you have to sort of section the ark off and keep some away from others because they'll enforce the food chain in a way that won't keep the two animals of each kind around? You think about that? Anybody think about that? I think there was actually in one of the.
I have a feed in some of the carnivorous animals.
Yeah.
You take extra other animals.
You know, we still don't know why we took seven of the clean ones. I'm sure that's not the reason, but.